During this segment, we'll be joined by Mrs. Data Fido, CEO of Africa Radio Drama Association, campaigner against female trafficking and domestic and international slavery. It's a pleasure to have you here. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
We continue our series on social entrepreneurship, focusing on people, profits, and planet. So far, we have talked about sustainable social entrepreneurship initiatives to improve our communities and the environment. And we've discussed the importance of ensuring profitability in a social enterprise. Today, our focus is on the ways in which social entrepreneurship can transform the lives of individuals and their communities. So, Mrs. Fido, tell us a bit about ADA, how the idea came about, and what sparked your interest in supporting underserved communities.
Okay. ADA in Nigeria, but it's actually a regional organization that started in Zimbabwe. In 1994, African sort of got, I was at that conference, and we sort of got together and determined that, to reach the poorest of the poor in Africa, that radio was, a very good medium. And unfortunately, at that time, videos were just coming into their own in popularity. And so there was less spending on radio, and what radio stations were then doing was just play music and play advertisements and no longer produce programs. If you ask them, they'd say they didn't have money or they didn't have the expertise. And this was at the same time when there was deregulation and, there were private licenses and there were so many more radio stations, but it was no longer being used, as a tool for development communication as it used to be in the olden days. So those of us at this conference decided to put ourselves together in an advocacy group that would return to our countries and sort of promote radio once again, to take up its role, in development. So we thought we'd come back, hold conferences with radio station producers and broadcasters. We thought we would advocate and push for better programming on radio. But when we came back and tried that, it didn't work. I thought, maybe what we should do is have a professional organization that will produce quality programs, produce content, development content, and then have them syndicated on radio stations. And that's what we started doing. So at the startup, our name was the African Radio Drama Association. And the radio speaks for itself, but drama was because we thought that programs ought to be entertaining. We borrowed a leaf from traditions of Africa, where most of our folk tales are entertaining, but then they are also educational. So we got that idea from that. We borrowed that idea from our oral traditions. And so most of our programming was drama, either in serial form or series or, other entertaining formats rather than just music and talk. So that's what we started doing. We produced a lot of radio dramas. We're able to attract funding from international organizations. Apparently, this was an idea that was attractive, that everybody thought was a good one. There was a niche for it. So we started doing that, and this was in 1998. Actually, we started in 1996, but started actually properly broadcasting in 1998. So since then, we've been working all over country, some other countries in Africa, and we produce radio programs of all kinds. Then we recently moved from broadcasting or producing programs on radio to TV and producing videos, training videos, all kinds of formats. So we thought, you know, and we've been doing this for a while now, we thought that when we, our name was just a bit of a misnomer, because we're doing every other thing, you know. I think basically what we do is to use the most accessible, most appropriate medium of communication. So it doesn't have to be radio. It could be social media. It could be live dramas, live theater. You know, it could be community discussion groups. It could be anything, anything that would work. So we are actually a one-stop development communication outfit. So we've changed our name. We left, we kept the ARDA acronym because everybody knows us as ARDA. We didn't want to lose it, but we are Development Communication Incorporated. So we've recently changed our name and rebranded, you know, to be more effective, to be more accessible and known, you know. So we've been around, you know, for over 25 years, and we've worked with all kinds of international and national organizations and donors, attracted donors, funding, and we also generate our own funding as well. So that's ARDA. So why do I have an interest in underserved communities? Well, right from the conference, we realized that a lot of our people, the poorer, low literate segment of our population, mostly living in rural areas, didn't have access to communication channels other than radio. And we wanted to offer them a link, you know, a communication link that would be meaningful to them, it would be accessible to them, and in their languages. It doesn't have to be English. They don't have to read print materials or newspapers, or have problems with electricity, so they don't have TV. But, you know, radio reached them in their communities, in their own languages. And that was my feeling, that we could provide information and education that will improve their lives. You know, that's why we started ARDA.
Amazing. So thinking about that moment when you were at that conference and you thought, as a group, we're going to do this, if we rewind back to your own life and your background in theater arts, can you talk to us about the turning point for you where you realize that your profession could really inspire and be a source of inspiration to underserved communities?
Well, you know, when I started in university to study theater arts, it was something that I was good at and something that I thought was fun, was my passion, but I didn't really see the link, you know, of how that could actually be a tool for development until my second year, when, you know, we had a community theater segment to our curriculum, when we had to live in a community and work with the community members to identify a problem and actually help the community come up with solutions using performing arts. I saw how that worked, and that just inspired me. And all, you know, I just thought, this is really where I should be doing, you know, expending my energy. And so when I graduated, I started working at the radio station. I became a producer at Radio Rivers, and was there for a couple of years, but I sought for a scholarship to do a master's, you know, and this time I wanted to do my master's in theater for development, which was what I did. And so when I returned from that, from my master's, after my master's degree, I the first jobs that I got were in development, in as consultant, you know, to either do research or, you know, come up with communication strategies on certain topics. And one of the very, very first things I worked on was eradicating female genital mutilation. In those days, it was called female circumcision. I was the National Union of Nigerian Nurses and Midwives, you know, had a project. I was able to get them funding from an international organization, and they hired me as a communication consultant on the project. So that was how I started working away from the media, but then still in, designing communication strategies, you know, on projects. So I worked with that group, and then later started working with UNICEF, then got a job with the Johns Hopkins University in the Nigerian office. I was a program officer, you know, and each time I tried to bring all of the experiences and knowledge that I had managed to put together, and of course my interest with radio, you know, so I was always pushing for programs for radio and programs for community people, you know, trying to do community outreach and having people have a voice by, you know, generating discussions with them. So I guess I always knew that this was where I was supposed to be from my second year in university, you know. So working at JHU, Johns Hopkins University, I decided, you know, once we came back from the conference, you know, I decided it might be good for me to resign and start ARDA with a couple of friends. And so we started it, and it worked. It took off almost immediately. So, yeah, that's what happened.
That's amazing. So let's segue then into the potentials that we have at the bottom of the pyramid. As you know, the bottom of the pyramid at the it's the lowest part, the people that are most underserved. So what would you say are the potentials? What do you think?
I think that people, from what I've observed and experienced over the years, working with community people, the poorest people within communities, and that people have a sense of dignity and really want to do things for themselves. And in the past, using communication, which is the area that I'm in, I would say that in the past, communication has always seemed to be, especially communicating with the poor, it's always been seen as, you know, talking to them, telling them, and those are the objectives, really, that most communication projects would have. They say, oh, we're going there, raising awareness, we're telling them to change their behavior, we're doing this. You know, so it's always about from top to bottom, like telling people what to do, rather than organizing them to become agents of their own change. And so our methodology at ARDA is a bit different. So we go into the communities, and community members are also their own, I think they are their own experts, right? Those of us coming from outside, we have to just be humble enough to learn from them and what makes them tick, what is going on with them, and why they do what they do. So, you know, that going into the communities to organize them means that you're going to go there with some level of humility. And the only thing that actually takes us there is the passion we have, you know, and the empathy that we have, that people can actually live better than they are living. And, you know, for me, this started from the time I was very, very young. I observed how poverty starts and how it can be generational. And from my observation in River State, from where I come, I come from Okrika, I noticed the poorest people are usually, how that always starts is a teenager, maybe she was in primary school and gets pregnant out of wedlock. And then they take her out of school, you know, so she doesn't complete school. She becomes a young mother, and it starts to spiral downwards from there, because, you know, you think about it, there are not many options, you know, for her. And mostly it's women, because the men in those days, they have options, you know. Most likely the man responsible for the pregnancy will continue with his schooling. And even after that, he could fish. He could take a canoe and have a partner, and they would go to the high seas and fish. And in those days, that created some revenue for fishermen. And they were not poor people, fishermen. But this young girl that's, you know, been withdrawn from school because she was pregnant, you know, that's it. So her life has already been curtailed. And if you look at it, her children will likely not have a better life either, because things are hard for them, you know, to send them to school and things like that. So that circle of poverty was something that I observed, you know, and I was thinking that some of the work that I was involved in was like looking at ways to provide services for young people, you know, counseling services or family planning services, you know. But there's a lot of pushback because of cultural values, cultural, you know, the way that we think in our communities that young people shouldn't have access to sexual and reproductive health messages, you know. So I see the opportunity for that, you know. First of all, you know, approach youngsters with information that could make them have goals, you know, and delay maybe sexual relationships or use, you know, protection. You know, those are some of the conversations that we should be having with young people. So it starts from when you're young, you know, what kind of goals do you set for yourself? Where are you headed? Where are you going? You know, and some things can happen that will just scuttle your journey and, you know, set you to poverty area, you know. So looking at the bottom of the pyramid, you know, you look at all of the additional factors that, you know, get people to stay in that bottom heap. How do we get them out of it? What kind of opportunities are there for them? There's plenty of opportunities, because these are people with dignity and want to work hard. They just need a bit of help, you know. So I look at other countries and other places where people are serious about getting people out of poverty. It's not about throwing a few thousand naira at someone, you know, and hoping that would get them out of poverty. It's systemic, so you need to address it, you know, systemically. And where people are trying to be productive, how can you help them to, you know, to expand, you know, their productivity, to enable them, you know, just survive and then go beyond survival. I know about a lot of people talk about microcredits and small credits and so on, and those are okay in the short term. But somebody is on the right path. You give somebody maybe 20,000 naira small credits, you know, and they're on the right path. They're doing some. They're frying akara, or she's doing all sorts of things, and her family is feeding. And then something happens, you know. Some tragedy happens, someone falls very sick, someone needs surgery, or, you know, those kind of things that can happen. And then, you know, all that money is gone. And then now they're in debt, you know. So microcredit to me is not just, it's not really the answer. I would rather look at ways in which people who are producing can have markets, maybe, you know, they can pull together in communities. And then maybe, you know, have value for what they are producing, you know, in a sustainable way. That's how I like rather look at how people can get out of poverty.
Right. Amazing. So one of the things that's really come out from this conversation is your passion for young people, and specifically for young women. Now, you were talking about people coming out of their situation and looking perhaps for economically for greener pastures. And we know that one of the big traps, right, for girls, for women, is this issue of servitude, whether it's domestic or international, being trafficked in a sense to serve people and actually not being paid for it. And this is something that you've worked against, that you've campaigned and advocated against. Can you talk to us a bit about that?
Well, again, you know, it comes back to the poverty of young women, you know, in our communities, and just the sense of responsibility that women seem to be born with, you know, or if not born with, imposed on us, you know, from the time we're little. So you find a woman, a young woman, feeling like, I have to do whatever I can to help my family. And then, you know, she hears of an opportunity abroad where you could go and work and earn money in foreign exchange. So she thinks, what am I doing? I'll do it, you know. I'll serve people. I'll do such fantastic job. They're never going to complain about me. I'm going to do it. So she's happy and she goes abroad. And what does she find when she gets there? She finds that it's actually another word for domestic servitude. So, or slavery, actually, modern day slavery, because they actually treat you like you're a slave, you know. So this is happening increasingly, you know, and nobody is coming back to tell the community people. And so they keep sending more and more people abroad. But fortunately for us, if you have returned and are willing to be spokespersons on what is really going on there. And apart from the UK, Europe and America, they are also being taken to the United Arab, what are they called, UAE, and in the countries and in the Middle East, and there they are actually called slaves, you know, and treated badly. They are flogged and maltreated, and some of them have actually lost their lives and been buried, and nobody even can tell where their bodies were buried. So This is shocking, and it's sad, and it's because people are looking for a way to survive or to help their families survive. So this is a message that we share with community members. If the job offer sounds too good to be true, it's probably not that. It's probably too good to be true. It's probably not correct. So don't always make all your inquiries. Don't always jump at every offer that you receive. So those are some of the messages that we're sharing with people. But in spite of that, you know, you of course know about certain parts of the country where it's very popular for people to go to Europe for prostitution. And at first, you know, those women didn't know what they were going for. But now, when we have discussions with them, we find out that they know. They are aware. The awareness is high that what they're going for, they're going to be expected to be prostitutes. But they are willing to go. You know, how bad can it be that you would prefer a thing like that, despite everything that people who have experienced it are telling us, you know, there are still women who would do everything to go. So, you know, it's how to express or communicate the dangers of it, so people really buy in it. For some reason, people are thinking, yeah, I'll go. It's hard work. It's going to be horrible, I know, but we're going to be able to have a better life in Nigeria when I return. So that's the mentality. That's what they're believing, you know. So how to counter that is what we're still struggling to do. And sometimes people who have returned have agreed to be spokespeople, to be to speak with other people, to counsel people not to go. I think that's powerful. If you've done it and you've seen it, maybe people then will listen. So it's also about community, raising community awareness, you know, to see if maybe in their communities they can, you know, they can raise themselves out of poverty if they are together, if they can plan together and reimagine their community, you know, together. Maybe there will be other options, you know. For example, in some communities in Kwara State where they're farming or raising animals and so on, and able to deliver the milk, you know, they're able to deliver milk, households are able to deliver milk every day to WAMCO, the company that produces milk, you know. There's a company adjacent to some of those villages, and they say, okay, we'll collect your milk, we'll buy your milk. And so, you know, the farmers can see a reason why they should take care of animals and take care of their either cows or goats and produce milk for the company. The same thing with other farming communities where they'll be able to produce maybe cassava or soya bean or whatever. As an individual, you may not be able to produce enough to satisfy the company, but if as a group together, as a cooperative together, perhaps they could, you know. So there are examples that some people are able to get out of poverty or, you know, open their communities up to prospects, you know. So maybe those are some of the examples that we should be sharing with other people.
Amazing.
Who think their communities are good.
Yes, hopefully we can help in reviving all our communities. So as you know, this program is called Rivers of Unicorns, and a unicorn is a private company valued at $1 billion or more. So we have a fun question for you. If you could be any unicorn, which one would you be?
Which one? I like Google for its open source, you know. You can Google any topic, and you know, so I like that. Maybe I would like to be that. It's popular, it's pervasive, and I think it's rich, right? It's up to 4 billion or more or something. So I like Google. I also like Expedia, the travel people, you know. Something like Expedia, you know. So a travel company, because I love to travel. So maybe, what would I like to be really? I think Google.
Fantastic. Mrs. Data Fido, it has been such an honor. This is all the time we have for this amazing discussion. Thank you for helping us reimagine our communities and work towards rebuilding them. Amy? Why don't you tell us what book you're recommending for our listeners today?
Great. So this is an amazing book. It's titled Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future, written by Ashley Vance. Have you read this book, Mrs. Data?
No, it's not one of the kind of books I read.
Okay, so but if
it's good, I'll read it.
Okay. Oh, it is good. So
okay, tell me about it.
Yes, I have two reasons why I want you and our listeners to read this book. The first reason is that it's pretty much, so for those people that know Elon Musk, right, he's someone you consider to be a visionary and an innovator. And what this book explores, it shows the characteristics he has, how he dares to be different, regardless of what is going on. And not just that, he then takes the necessary actions. Because, you know, it's one thing to have that dream. It's another thing to put it to action and walk towards it. That's the first reason. The second reason is because it also shows his tenacity. Now, he didn't have immediate success. He had tried different things that failed, but despite that, he was able to still persist, and he also had the attitude of learning, which the book also explores. It shows that aspect of him, where from right from childhood, he took out time to read books and learn things. He was born in South Africa, not America, as most people think. So he pretty much came out of an environment where he believed that things could be different, and he was willing to learn and to be committed to that process. So it's really an inspiring book for people to read, and especially for business people, because for both, I mean, as a businesswoman, you know this as well, for both aspiring and existing business people, it's not the journey is never easy. So you being able to have that tenacity and drive to do the things necessary to bring your dreams to reality, that's what's going to help you go through. So that's why I am recommending this book today.
Okay. Thank you. I'll read it, I think.
Great. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Tafido. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you, Sotoy and Emmy. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.
That's it, folks. We've come to the end of today's episode, which was brought to you by NetOps, an organization focused on building people and systems in Africa to leverage internet opportunities for social and economic development. In partnership with the Kaywood Brown Foundation, a youth empowerment and development foundation focused on preparing the leaders of tomorrow, today. You can learn more on the foundation's work through their website, www.kaywoodbrownfoundation.org. I'll take that again. That's www.kaywoodbrownfoundation.org. And be sure to follow them on their various social media handles. On Facebook and Instagram, it's at Kaywood Brown Foundation. And on Twitter, it's at KWB Foundation. I'll take that again. On Facebook and Instagram, it's at Kaywood Brown Foundation. And on Twitter, it's at KWB Foundation. So, we hope you've been inspired to start looking at the problems in your communities as marketable solutions. If you do and you need help, please log on to our website, www.riversofunicorns.com. I'll take that once more. That's www.riversofunicorns.com. And be sure to sign up for our useful resources. We'd like to say special thanks to Niner Tech, Maxuron Records, Techative, and Daughters of Botany for contributing to make this episode possible. Until the same time next week, we are your hosts, Amy and Sotoye. Have a lovely weekend!